The following is Mark Reddick's featured talk, Change the Story and the Conversation, from the 2016 UX Immersion Interactions Conference.
I'd like to start with a story, but in order to tell that story, so the story contains a reference that, you know, where I grew up in Montana, everybody just knew this reference. But I've since learned that not everybody knows this reference. So first I have to tell a different story in order to tell the real story. And this story, well, there's long and short versions of it. I'm going to tell the short version. A couple had a young son. About 5 years old, they started to realize this boy had developed kind of an extreme personality. He was extremely optimistic, unfailingly optimistic, to the point that, you know, they started to worry, he's just going to get killed once he gets to school, once he gets out in life. We got to do something about this. So at the advice of a psychiatrist, the father decided to intervene. And he took the boy to a room piled nearly to the ceiling with horse manure. The son, I have something for you. When he took him to this room, the place smelled terrible. It was an awful pile. But instead of showing disappointment, the boy squealed with delight and climbed up onto the manure pile and just started digging with his bare hands, digging in this pile. I'm like, son, what are you doing? The father was mystified. And the boy, with a gleaming smile on his face, says, with all this horseshit, there's got to be a pony in here somewhere. So that's the optimism story. Oh, I drew you a picture. I'm always thinking of you. So now I can tell my real story. I don't know, it was maybe 2000, 2001, something like that. User experience was really catching on. There were these agencies cranking up, you know, making piles of money, doing UX consulting. And other firms, some of the more like technology consulting firms, wanted to get in on the game. And I kind of misspent a year working in what had been a technology consultancy, and they're building their UX practice. And the way they did that was they hired a bunch of mostly graphic designers, mostly from ad agencies. And then they hired almost anyone with the word cognitive in the name of their degree, or usability people, HCI people, yeah. And they said, great. And they called them creatives and cognitives. So the project manager would call and he would say, we need two cognitives and a creative on this project. So I had the job of trying to help wrangle this into an actual practice. So about 3 months in, I had this idea that maybe instead of jetting around and dropping in on these difficult situations, maybe we could have a center. And people could learn, and clients could learn. And so I worked up this pitch and a budget and had these ideas. And it was time to go present to my boss, whose name was Bruce, because we needed executive approval for space and money and so on. So I prepared this presentation, and now it's me and Bruce and one of his senior management peers, and I'm giving this presentation. A lot weighs on it, and about two-thirds of the way through, Bruce looks at the other manager, and he says, there's got to be a pony in here somewhere. So that signaled to me that he considered what he'd heard so far a pile of horse manure. Yes? So I drew you a picture of that too. I drew Bruce as a blue genie and myself as a kind of supplicant, you know. This is all going to come together. I'm just going to keep telling stories for a second. I promise it'll tie together. Okay, here's another story. It's bigger than we thought. This was work at a big global company, and it was healthcare products division, and they were saying, you know, there's a lot of people in China. Maybe we could go there. So the question was, how much do we have to change our brand and our products in order to be appealing in China? And so we were part of it, and so were some engineers and product designers and a bunch of branding and marketing specialists. One of the things we did was curate what we called a strategic immersion. So it was something like 10 days, and we visited homes, and we visited hospitals, and we interviewed hospital executives, and everybody got a checkup from three different kinds of Chinese doctors and foot massages and all kinds of things. And we reflected in the field, and we all together, these three kinds of people, learned some things. So we saw that modern and traditional approaches are blending. And we saw this culture of lifelong exercise, from regimented exercise in the schoolyard to people in the parks, older people in the parks doing Tai Chi. We saw over and over again this attitude that food is medicine, and your choice of what to eat is part of thinking about your own wellness and your family's wellness. And these definitions of wellness, like wellness is balance and illness is unbalance. So it was less about symptoms and let me get rid of the symptoms. It's why am I out of balance? Help me get back into balance, even if that takes some time. And we had experiences like in the morning, it was a hot day, went into a place that sold smoothies that sounded so great. They wouldn't sell them to us because cold on a hot day, they said it has ice in it. And we know. And they got ice and showed it to us because they didn't think we understood. Like, but please, would you have a smoothie? Like, no, hot tea for you. So, and going to visit people in their homes, and people that asking, they brought us cups of hot water because they're taking care of us, yeah? Different. Over and over again, we bumped into this issue of generational shifts where there has been this system of younger generations caring for older generations. They're now living apart, and there's a possible kind of a crisis going on of elder care. So coming out of all of that, the question changed from how will we have to change our products? Like, we went in thinking, well, how do we change to sell the same stuff? Like, this is bigger than we thought. This isn't only a product marketing and design decision. We came face to face with this kind of, well, this says dance between old traditions and modern, and some remarkably compelling narratives about wellness. So what if we were a wellness company, not a medical products company? What it would look like for us to embody the wellness is balanced tradition in global products? Like, could we bring some of that back to the West? So basically, the team's conversation changed, and then they tried to change the internal conversation to be even more strategic than we started out. So I drew a picture of that, which is quite a contrast with the Bruce picture, yes? We're sort of this group of explorers wandering off into some territory we hadn't been to before. So let's compare that. Bruce, that conversation was this boss subordinate genie supplicant situation, and China, a band of explorers. And when I met with Bruce, you know, really that's not that great a situation. It was this rare meeting. We hadn't really talked about our view of what was going on and the agendas. I was just pitching from my point of view, and he was listening from his point of view. But in China, we had this very mixed group. We had the sponsorship of stakeholders. We had interviewed the stakeholders. And the mode with Bruce was like, I'm presenting to persuade. And this group in China was doing curious exploration together. Very different. So I'm using a big definition of conversation here, yes? Serve an unspoken business agenda. He never really said why he thought it was horse manure, versus serve the future of the business and the future of wellness. So since Bruce and China, I've experienced a change in perspective. And that, in turn, has changed my view of organizations and design and research and leadership. And that, in turn, has changed how I see work and how I work. And there's basically kind of a whole university course there, but I'm just going to talk about two aspects of this. One is how I see organizations. So I used to see organizations either as kind of command and control, top-down structures. That's kind of how we're taught in textbooks. Sometimes I saw them as like, look, I'm just trying to do the work I want to do, but I'm in the woods here. I don't really know what's going on. All I can see is what's around me. I just want a place to do good work so other people are taking care of it. I don't know how they understand what's going on, but I'm glad they do. And, you know, I thought I was alone in this, but basically I have felt lost in every organization bigger than 15 people that I've been an employee of. And this was another view of organizations that for most of my mid-career, there was something I wanted to shift, but I felt powerless to shift it. But now my picture is that an organization is a living process. You know, more like an ant colony than an org chart, except it's not ants responding kind of mechanically to pheromones. It's people in conversation with each other, full of emotions and not always acting rationally. So I think this has been one of the problems with organizational change efforts don't have a very good reputation, partly because they've been taking this command and control and kind of mechanistic view of organizations with the idea that things will go according to plan if you can just incent people or mandate things. But really the organization's almost entirely made of relationships. The way people see each other, the way people see the world, the way they see themselves in relationship to each other in the world, and those things form structures, and patterns of behavior operate across those structures. I know that's abstract, but we'll go somewhere with it. The organization's made of us, and we're influenced by it. There's this really amazing circular relationship between individuals and system. And this is true at families, you know, families, school, classroom, here at the conference. What's going on is made of us, but we're influenced by things like the conference script. So here's a little video of, I think it's about 3 minutes long, of something that we do. One of the things I do with my colleague is teach at Carnegie Mellon University School of Visual Arts. And we try to give students experiences so that it's not just an abstraction, this idea that we're participating in a system, but they actually get to live it in kind of in a miniature way. So take a look here at this. So that systems game is an amazing experience. It almost always works. And then we sit and talk about the implications, you know. So people will say things like, well, I hope you understood the rule. So you pick two people, you start in a circle. You pick two people, and your job is to when you say go, your job is to maintain an equal distance between yourself and those other two. So then you move around. So you're like, well, I knew I was following two people, but then once we sat down, I realized people were following me. And then the standing up kind of has that same effect. And when we're standing up, you detect these little subsystems, these little sub-webs of relationship. So it's quite powerful to experience it personally. And there's all sorts of like systems lessons, systems facts about complex dynamic systems that you can learn from this. Well, the way that this is affecting my work is I'm starting to see that participating in a system is an act of either reinforcing its patterns or of leading an invitation to shift its patterns. Yeah, participation is an act of change or leadership, and we can't help but participate. So now, rather than trying to show Bruce a pony, can I do something that would attract others to participate? And if something good develops when they are attracted, can I stabilize it? And can I reinforce that, or maybe even amplify it? So now I see myself as being in the business of pattern shifting. Meanwhile, most of our communication toolkit comes from a view of organizations as more transactional, where we send and present and equip. Emphasis is on individuals. And there's a body of methods, a body of ways of working that more emphasize mutual discovery, mutual creation, and pattern shifting, which is some of the things we explored yesterday in the workshop. You can see some of that in the handouts are available. So I see it as made of conversations. This is kind of the other part, not just seeing it as systems, but seeing that these are systems made of conversations. As Jared said in the introduction, a lot of what we talk about when we have shop talk is about these special activities. You know, we did research. Oh, no, we worked out the design brief, and we did research, and we made journey maps, and we did a presentation, we did a prototype. So there are these artifacts and special moments that are the focus of most of our conversation. But the truth is, those things are all come from thousands of conversations and decisions. They're just kind of a little ritual in this stream, this confluence of rivers and creeks of conversation and activity that are going on all the time, and not just at the office. They're going on the phone, and they're going on in the bars, and they're going on in the lunchroom. So the more I've realized this and taken on this different perspective, the more I've been faced with the question, well, how do we work? Here's a story about working conversationally. We were early in this question, how do we work? We're just starting to accumulate some methods and tools and things that we would love to practice in a corporate setting, but we were a little scared because it seemed different than what people were used to doing. But we had a call from a pretty senior manager in about a 300-person IT organization in this pretty large international food company. And he said, we need to get better at requirements gathering. Really, why do you say that? Because so they make all this software for all these other departments, right? They make software for manufacturing and sales and marketing and executives and so on. Why do you say you need to get better at requirements gathering? Well, people don't like what we make. They don't use it. They use Excel spreadsheets instead, right? They're not using this stuff. So, oh, well, how do you decide what to make? Well, once a year, our director gets together with the directors from all the other departments, and they set the project agenda for the year. Oh, so you don't talk to these people? Like, well, no. So they're making software for sales, but they don't talk to sales, yeah? So we said, maybe rather than requirements gathering, let's try getting some people together across these boundaries, and you can actually be in the same room with them. And maybe the question can be, how might something better show up? Let's not assume the answer yet. So we got, I think there were a dozen or so people in the basement of a farmhouse for like 4 days, and we just picked one department. It was sales and IT. And so I just want to kind of briefly show you, I'm not going to tell the whole story of the 4 days, but I want to briefly show you some of the activities that we did to set up for telling you about principles. so you can get an idea of what it looks like to try to work conversationally. So this is us taking our first steps into this kind of work. So the first question when we got together was from IT, like, who are you guys? Like, how can we really see you? IT, who are you? Each group worked together to answer this series of questions designed to help them be seen by the other group, yeah? So here they are in the basement. There was a magnificent number of pipes in that basement. I don't know why. The first question was, what are you really good at? What value do you bring to others and to the whole company? And then the second question was, what do you need in order to do a good job? So IT in one side and sales in the other side wrote on these big sheets the answers to these questions. Third question, where do your outside expectations come from? Who's asking you for things, holding you accountable? Fourth, what kind of projects or situations bring out the best, like make you excited to get out of bed in the morning? And the fifth question is, you know, you don't have to answer this, but if you want, you could tell us your undiscussables, the elephants in your room, the important topics you just don't talk about because you're afraid or they're uncomfortable, or it just doesn't seem okay. So they answered that, and then they told each other about their world. And already this interest, because, you know, sales comes to IT and says, well, we have stereotypes. We see through our stereotypes. So they said their expectation was, well, they're not going to be very socially apt, and they're going to talk of technical jargon. We're going to hear a lot of jargon. They had these stereotypes. And the IT guys think the sales guys just want to shake your hand all the time. They smell like cologne. They I don't know exactly. Everybody had stereotypes. They talk. Oh, God, they talk all the time. So already we're an hour in, and those labels and presuppositions are falling away. And they're starting to look at each other with admiration. Like, I didn't know that about you. The second question was, well, what's going on? Now that we kind of see who each other is, the groups learned a lot about each other. So now they worked again in separate groups, and they responded to questions aimed at bringing out a description of their current situation. And we designed these to kind of steer the conversation toward a possibility focus rather than a problem focus, rather than what's broken now, what's possible now, which is a very powerful thing to do. If you can shift a conversation from problem focus to possibility focus, you've made a big step. So again, we gave them these worksheets. So each sheet had these three categories: people and things, organizational process and structure, values and purpose, relationships, values and purpose. So the first sheet was, what are your seeds? These are the things that exist that have a lot of potential that you would like to continue in the future and grow larger in the future. And the second sheet was your stones. These are things that get in the way of the seeds growing. They're barriers. And they could be internal or external. And then they listed the weeds, the things you're doing now that you would like to stop doing. Avoid taking into your future, somehow pull those weeds. So again, they made these lists, they showed them to each other, and now you can kind of start to see lights turning on between these two groups, because, like, I think we can help you guys with that. Oh, I didn't know that you had that seed. We kind of need that thing to grow, right? The people are starting to light up a little bit. So then we did this exercise so this is something we did yesterday in the workshop, this situation modeling workshop. Only yesterday we modeled situations. In this workshop, they made models of kind of the essence of IT. What's the heart of it? And, you know, what's your real core purpose, your real identity? And I'll be brief about this. This is one of the models where what came out in the story about this model was one of balance. Then they made individual models, and then they made these group models. So one thing I'll say about this is a place where we were scared, because these are like middle America, middle-aged, conservative IT guys, you know? They're not artists, they're not poets, you know? We're asking them to do these things, like just work with these materials. So my colleague is really good at kind of setting up why. There's a bringing in your intuitive side, not just your analytical side. There's a very reasonable story about why to do this. So we said, okay, so make a model. And he's like, well, okay. And they just did it. There was no pushback. There was no... So we're finding that we often underestimate people's willingness to work creatively and to go deep in their conversation. This led to kind of a moment in talking about their model. What came out was a shift in their identity towards possibility, because they had written, "We are great makers. You give us something to do and we'll make something. And we're good at it and it'll be reliable." But at some point, it's partly because of hearing sales say, "You know what, I think you're underselling your ability." And they crossed out makers and wrote creators. We're creators. So now we have the conditions in place for this group of people, sales and IT, to create together. They stepped away from the way things are. They stepped out of their office, and they stepped away from their stereotypes, and they stepped away from the old conversations. They got past the usual stories of judgment. They got past the stories of, "I better deliver," or, "I won't be able to keep my job," you know, kind of stuff. The room is full of this honesty and openness, this sense of possibility. They feel like they've really been heard and understood. They see their situation in a new way together, and they've been laughing. Since silliness, there's a great John Cleese talk about creativity, and one of the things he points out is that silliness and humor is essential to creativity, and that was present in the room. So I'll cut it short. You get the idea, I think. But this illustrates where the conversation went by the end. They wound up doing lots of concepts and an actual roadmap. But you can see on this quadrant that, so the lower left is we're working independently and we're reactive. So we're order takers. So people tell us what to do and we work by ourselves to do it. So that's what led to the phone call. People don't like what we make. But they realized that, partly from sales talking to them in a different way, they realized that they were being invited to be partners with the rest of the organization, to be leaders, to ask to be more proactive, and to work in a more integrated way. So the concepts they were coming up with was, how do we move up and to the right on this map? Yeah? Which was a really different conversation than help us get better at requirements gathering. So that story illustrates some goals or principles that we now bring to our work. One is increase the surface area. Jared has an article out there pointing out that there's a correlation between the amount of time that a team spends with its customers and the quality of the result. And I think it goes on to say there's this kind of frequency in an amount of exposure, but this idea of exposure time increasing quality. And I sure agree with that. And I'd add another way to increase exposure, which is to increase surface area. And by that I mean, what's your answer to the question, how much of your organization actually touches the outside world? I mean, of course, everybody goes home at night to their families and they bowl and go to church and stuff, you know, they have kids in soccer, but that's not the organization touching the lives that it affects with its decisions. So, you know, if you remember that the view of organizations are that their process is made of patterns of conversations, and we tend to keep having the same conversations with the same people. So we're repeating these patterns. And in my experience, even conversations about innovation are often caught in these internal bubbles, yeah, with small surface area that just sort of poke out and send a researcher out into the world once in a while. And so it's a very powerful pattern shifting technique to increase surface area. So what I mean by that China story is an example of taking people from across multiple silos and really getting them in touch. Yesterday in the workshop, we tried a thing called collective story harvest. 10 people told stories, and people listened to those stories through very particular lenses that focused their attention on a particular aspect of the story, like leadership or principles or moments that really were a turning point in the story. And so if you gather diverse people from across the organization, maybe you can't take 100 people outside to do research, right? And it's hard to get your executives to go do research. But you can gather them to listen to stories for a few hours, and then you can set the conditions for them to move their center of attention outside their judgment by giving them a particular way to listen, and then spend some time combining. So we had to kind of do a hasty job yesterday, but if there were 10 stories in the room, and here are engineers and executives and sales and quality and call center listening to these stories, now we can hear, okay, in this room, we heard 10 stories. What did we learn about turning points in these customers' lives from all these stories? So we can harvest, we can combine insights from all these stories. So it's one example, both of increasing exposure time and surface area. And the workshop handout points to a few other kinds of methods that you might use for this. Another goal or principle is increase the diversity. In a lot of organizations, I guess, what's the metaphor? There's lumps in the gravy. There's a lot of bubbles. So it's not only departments and tiers of the organization, but it's like the new guys or the people that play baseball together. You know, there's all these little bubbles where they mostly communicate with each other, and then they have less communication out. And often our processes work with lumps. We work with the team, or we work with the innovation management or something, yeah? So not always very diverse. So increasing surface area becomes way more powerful if you also increase the diversity of people that have contact with outside the world. So if you do story harvest, get lots of different kinds of people in there. And that will change the conversation between the bubbles, because now they have this experience they had together, and they talk about it, yeah? So we have a couple of slogans. One is convene diversity and power. And especially to convene power may take kind of a process of going around and really listening to senior people. It can be a 15-minute phone call, or it can be a 90-minute interview where you're trying to get at things like, you wouldn't ask the question this way, but you're trying to get at, what actually do you care about? Like, what are you trying to make happen in this organization? And why? Like, what brought you here? And where do you think you want to, like, you get down to what these folks really care about until you can make an invitation that touches on that care. And so you're trying to convene a group that actually can have some legitimacy and affect a larger organizational conversation. But you can't always do that. So our other principle is convene the people that show interest. Often that means convening the pioneers. So in the conversation about UX and design culture, we've bumped into people in big organizations who, where their strategy was, you know, half of these product groups have somebody that has read Don Norman or taken an online HCI course or something like that. They're kind of pioneers, they're not trained designers, but let's start connecting them. So you're connecting diversity across the organization. And now, if you can get the diversity in touch with the outside world, you're increasing diverse surface area. It's quite powerful. Okay, third of four, humanize. I worked for a couple of years with a now past wonderful guy and designer and strategist named John Reinfrank. And one of the things he would do, especially in a stuffy corporate setting, not in a meeting, but, you know, if it was like walking down the hallway, he worked with pretty senior people. One of the things he would do was take his shoes off and sit down on the floor. It felt kind of like this radical act, you know? But now he and this other guy were just kind of, it touches the, brings, just invites the little boy or little girl into the room. We had an engagement with a Microsoft new product group. It lasted something like 9 months. So they were blazing away at this technology, and we and the manager we were working for were out looking at the slices of life that this technology was supposed to blend with. And he was having a hard time being heard. And so sometimes instead of meeting at the offices, we would take a walk in the woods outside Redmond. And it was on those walks in the wood that we could talk about the human pressures of the project and the humans that were applying the pressure and who they were and how they might respond to. This is one of the more vague principles, but it's a, when we start to work conversationally, we're realizing it's humans, not project managers or senior designers or budget control officers or something. They're humans. And a lot of the methods that we've been working with make it comfortable. We did a thing yesterday called World Cafe that basically sets up a cafe setting, and music is playing, and there's snacks on the table, and it's just kind of a structured way for a lot of people, for one room, to have one conversation, to listen to the room. It's utterly comfortable on-ramp to having a group conversation, and it's very human, because it has this familiar trappings of a cafe. And there's also a thing in this humanized thing of just kind of lightening up. Another John Cleese point about creativity is that very important matters especially benefit from humor and from a lighter touch. So we can be too serious. I think that's one reason I'm giving you little silly sketches. Okay, deepen. This is a fourth goal. One of the scariest, maybe, if you're just starting to kind of work in this way, but I think one of the most profound. And I don't mean reading poetry and talking about your insecurities and, you know, displaying your giblets. I mean that we can create the conditions in which the conversation moves from debate to curiosity, and then in which the conversation can move from curiosity to sense of possibility, where we're talking about the bigger story. We have this word imagination. And I learned from the poet David White that our idea of imagination, where we kind of make up stories, we think about fairy tales or something, is what the Celtic poets might have called secondary imagination, or they might have called it fantasy. Primary imagination is the ability to conceive of a story or see the story that helps you make sense of all the other stories. So in all of our organizations, there's something bigger that this organization is participating in. And for every one of our teams, there's something bigger that this team is helping to make come true over the longer term. So deepening the conversation for us means help create the conditions where the group can remember that they're participating in this bigger thing. It's not only about the next quarter. It's not only about, you know, meeting the numbers. One other point about this, there's this idea of courageous conversation. Sometimes in our planning, you know, it's not so much deepening. We may talk about courageous. Let's see if we can get to courageous conversation. Another thing I learned from White. It makes sense once you think about it. The root of courage is an old French word, cœur, yeah, heart. It's courage. It's wholeheartedness. So the courage isn't running into the bullets. Courage is being in touch with what makes you full of energy and wholehearted, yeah? And courage has heat. It's a creative fire. And that can burn away these divisions and these labels, these disagreements and stereotypes. So when I say deepen, I mean learning to move conversations below these surface patterns and stories into the realm of wholehearted creativity. So I think that this experience started to get there with these folks. And I am going to end there, and I think we'll have time for questions.
Thank you, Mark. So I'm going to ask you a similar question to the one I asked Dan. We have a lot of new people coming into the field. What are the traps that those folks fall into that we can catch them at an early time and get the conversations going in the right direction?
That's a question one should think about before he answers. Well, a thing that came up in conversation yesterday in the workshop, so it's not only new people, but maybe when you're new is your chance to try to do different, is especially when you're new, so many of us want to go to the cool job and the cool spot, and often those cool jobs are very fast-paced, and they're very high-pressure, and there's performance pressure. And we talked about reflection. Yesterday, we'd do something, and I'd say, okay, just take 2 minutes. You're going to be quiet. Write in your notebook.
Right.
Then it'll be quiet. I'm rambling because I don't have a specific recommendation, but I think, actually, can I totally diverge from that?
Yes.
There's a conclusion in my... That's why I have this piece of paper up here that I didn't read.
Okay.
Is that all right?
Yes.
Yes. Let's see if it's still worth reading. I think this is a point of view that I've had to work to embrace in the moment, in the heat of a project. If as a work culture, we can, over the coming years, start to adopt that and welcome new people into it instead of into the hasty pace, yeah? It's a point of view that says, because organizations are not machines, because people cannot be brought into new behaviors through compliance or explaining things to them, because the living system of an organization can't be influenced through command and control or pitch, let's let go of our transactional view of work. In our shop talk, it seems like we believe that if we just get the journey map right or show them highlights videos or we can revise that presentation one more time, we'll finally have the impact we've been wanting to have and we'll finally ship a product that makes life better. But it's not the journey map or the video or the presentation. It's the conversations that surround them and the conversations that led you to want to make them, the conversations that need to happen about what to make. And most important, the conversation about who we are together and what's our relationship to the rest of the world and what's the bigger story and arc of history in which we're participating. So there's this idea of the conversation being the work. If you can move yourself towards being a holder of stories, so equip storytelling as being at the heart of our work and story holding, the story and the conversation will do the work and get people to wholeheartedness. I'm kind of skipping around here.
Do you think that designers have a natural proclivity to storytelling, that there's something in the way that we formulate the problems that we're trying to solve and come up with the solutions that in our heads we're sort of always telling ourselves stories and the way we communicate and that storytelling becomes a critical skill for designers to be successful?
I think everybody is always telling themselves stories in their heads, but I think design, I'll say that my colleague Hannah and I have sometimes thought, like, are we still in the UX and design community or are we doing something else? And the more we look at what's going on in the design community, we're like, that's home. This is a bunch of people that actually have the potential to work in this way, to be excited about these points of view, to adopt them and sort of carry them forward. So I think this is a frontier of design practice that I'm talking about.
Good.
Yeah.
We have time for one question. It seems that we have a question. There we go. Thank you for being near the mic.
So being in a large organization, when you're talking about getting the IT team with the sales team, I'm sure that led to some really productive things like that. How then do they treat every other department like that, and then how does that relationship stay nurtured over time? Because you can't sort of be best friends with everyone in the company, right?
No, you can't. That turns out to not be possible. So there's what happened in that story, and then there's what we wished would have happened in that story. What happened in that story, so this is a thing we learned from that, because this was early, was that there was excited sponsorship for doing that workshop from both sides, but there was not commitment to carry it forward as part of a larger story of integrating, of becoming partners, yeah? So that move to partnership did not go all the way across the director level and all the relationships to all these other departments. Each had a director, yeah? So the sales thing was very healthy. There were things that came out of that, like they gave all the IT guys these passports. They were sales passports. And at the first, you're like, to get a stamp on your passport, you had to do the thing the page said. So it was just like, learn these three sales pieces of jargon, you know, these terms. And then you go tell it to a guy, and you say, well, yeah, that's right. And he, boom, you stamp your passport. But later, you had to do things like go right along for a day. Or the last one in this like 30-page book was to make a little documentary video about the sales organization. Yeah? So if you got a full passport, you were kind of famous in both places. So that was an experiment in mingling the departments, yeah, and giving incentive to do that. So there was an idea that it may look different in different departments, but if there was commitment to this, it would evolve through. So it didn't really happen that way, and it didn't really follow through the other departments, so far as I know. It's been a while since I talked to this guy. We have a different conversation up front now because of that, about what's this for? You know, where's it going? Like, why? And try to build that commitment, the conditions for its continuation. Did that help? Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you. Yeah.
For more information and videos from the UX Immersion Interactions Conference, visit our All You Can Learn library at aycl.uie.com. As always, thanks for listening.